Welcome to the UNIS Union of Madison. Our speakers today are Delita Chakrou and Susan Hagstrom, talking about journalist turned professor Jeff Charlotte. So take it away.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to know how many here have read some of Charlotte's books on the family or the fellowship. Hands up. All right, you will be very welcome to add during the comments because there's a lot of material in his books and there's no way I could get through the whole thing. So please feel free after the presentation. I'm going to begin with a condensed statement from the American Humanist Association. We are a progressive, non-theistic movement willing to work with friends and allies toward issues of common concern. Our ethical values are grounded in the philosophy of the Enlightenment, informed by scientific knowledge and driven by a desire to meet the needs of people in the here and now. We seek not only self-fulfillment, but the betterment of all society and the world in which we live. Ponder that as we discuss the family, also known as the fellowship, a secretive Washington, D.C.-based international network of fundamentalist political power brokers. Behind-the-scenes diplomacy is not new. What surprises me is the extent of the family's reach, the length of time it has been operating without public knowledge, its blatantly self-serving take on fundamentalism, and the terrible damage some of its brothers in Christ have inflicted, particularly its recruits internationally. The family's history and operations were made public, as some of you know, by Jeff Charlotte, author of The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. And then the sequel, which I think some of you have also read, C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. Charlotte's work earned him the label of enemy, later to be spied on by members of the family. Our presentation today is merely a glimpse of his extensive observations. The family, also known as the Fellowship, was founded in 1935. By a Norwegian immigrant preacher, Abram, and Charlotte pronounces it Vereed, Abram or Abram Vereed. Unable to improve his status by serving the poor, Vereed, who was strongly anti-union and New Deal, had a revelation from God. This was a very convenient revelation, as revelations tend to be. Only powerful people blessed by God are capable of helping the poor and calming the working class. Vereed's goal was to prepare the earth. Oh, and then powerful people needed someone, Vereed himself, to guide them toward that end. That was the rest of the revelation. Vereed's goal was to prepare the earth for Jesus' return to reign over his kingdom. To do so, Vereed must destroy unions, eliminate communism, bring the world's population to Jesus, and create governments in every nation that rule by God's law. That's a pretty big assignment. Vereed's elite fundamentalism is reminiscent, as some of you I'm sure know, of John Calvin, Jonathan Edwards, and the Christianist Reconstructionist Roussos Rushdoony. In 1942, Vereed held his first prayer breakfast at Hotel Willard in Washington, D.C. 74 men, mostly congressmen, listened to speeches by Vereed and the ultra-conservative president of the National Association of Manufacturers. Now, 76 years after Vereed heard a message from God, members of prayer cells throughout the world follow instructions they attribute to their creator. They seek a new world order, a phrase Vereed coined for a world governed by God's law, a law that separates God's chosen from the unchosen according to wealth, power, and class. In 1969, Vereed was succeeded by a young, energetic Oregonian named Doug Coe. In the name of developing obedient relationships with Jesus, Coe skillfully and silently and gently and sometimes really politely spread the family's gospel of power throughout the world. His intent was and is, like Vereed, to generate Christ-centered governments in every country. Now semi-retired, Coe is grooming Dick Foth, I think I'm saying that right, Dick Foth, longtime advisor to John Ashcroft, to carry on his mission. Doug Coe's human models of power include some of history's most violent tyrants. He claims not to condone their violence, yet overlooks violence perpetuated by dictators he recruits into the family. Charlotte provides chilling examples of family-endorsed international power gone awry. I was appalled to learn that Doug Coe's first international target was Haiti, where I have family connections. Through two Haitian officials, two U.S. senators, and 12 businessmen, Coe brought prayer cell politics to the Haitian parliament. Free markets and an elitist, Jesus-loving hierarchy that served the rich at the expense of the poor were firmly entrenched as supposedly decreed by God. Key members of the family advocated for the feared dictator Papadoc Duvalier. This netted God's chosen Duvalier U.S. foreign aid and exemptions on sugar tariffs. Following are mostly my comments and not Charlotte's. In more recent years, Bill Clinton undercut Haiti rice production by facilitating rice shipments to Haiti from his home in Arkansas. I'm not by any means implying that Bill Clinton is a member of the family or the foundation. Clinton apologized after countless livelihoods were destroyed. The post-earthquake Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund is gradually initiating long-term programs that promise jobs, training, and badly needed microloans. And if some of those are getting in process right now, and they may turn out to be pretty good. I hope they're not going to turn out to be sweatshops. But why weren't these donations from across the globe first used for ample clean water, a safe sewage system, and large-scale debris removal so people could rebuild their homes? That piece of it I don't understand. The money was badly needed, and it was there. And they're still collecting money worldwide for their longer term. But they're not here to answer for that, and I really don't know. But early donations could have prevented untold deaths and minimized the cholera epidemic, which is again on the upswing. And this is this kind of not paying attention to people who are really totally down and out and deprived that disturbs me greatly. George Bush and Bill Clinton do have connections to the family. And again, as far as I know, Bush is not a member. Bush belonged to a Bible study group in Midland, Texas, organized by a group the family started. Again, this does not imply membership in the family. Many politicians in Washington, D.C. have some dealings with the family. Every president since Eisenhower has attended the family's national prayer breakfast.
I said it also doesn't imply that they are not members of the family.
That's true. I guess I'm saying I don't know. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, views Doug Coe, the family leader, as a caring mentor and has attended family-run Bible study and prayer circles since she came to Washington in 1993. More recently, she's been attending weekly Senate prayer breakfasts and, according to some, is swaying farther to the right. I have to say I have great respect for what she has done, and particularly just hearing this, I think last night or this morning, the extent to which she has hired LGBT people in the State Department and is supporting that. As Charlotte tells it, the family's brotherhoods in Christ encourage personal relationships with Jesus and strict obedience to God. Through powerful political networks, these spiritual warriors promote undemocratic, authoritarian hierarchies that rule governments, economies, and armed forces according to God's dictates. I sent around an article that just showed some of the biblical quotes that are used by one organization, and this came from a link on a website that is connected to the family. So this is kind of related to some of their thinking in terms of spiritual warriors. Charlotte's C Street book has a disturbing section on the U.S. military that's worth a whole program in itself. So I'm not going to go into that much today. It's just really deserves a lot more than I could possibly give it. The founder of what is now the Officers Christian Fellowship was an admirer of Vereed, of his movement, and created prayer cells in West Point and Annapolis. Our current military, as some of you already know, is rife with officers and enlisted personnel intent on winning the world for Christ. And even though some work has been done at the Air Force Academy to try to counter that, it's alive and very well. Jeff Charlotte has been criticized for not focusing on the family's good works, which he acknowledges exist. Some people have found the family's counseling and spiritual guidance very helpful. But according to documents Charlotte unearthed in the family's archives, the family's good works cannot possibly compensate for the threat it poses to democracy. According to Charlotte, the family operates with circles of access to power. And this is not a new format. Some of you may be recognized by other people in history. With a personality in the center, in this case, Jesus. The innermost circle of key men are trained and mentored by Doug Coe and others of the family's elite. Surrounding the inner circle are active supporters, and then there are allies who may not be very aware of what's really going on. Within U.S. power circles are an unknown number of United States administrative officials, congressmen, diplomats, military officers, and state politicians. In a study of 360 evangelical elites that was done at Rice University by a sociologist by the last name of Lindsay, one in three interviewees mentioned either Doug Coe or the fellowship as an important influence. Lindsay says there's no other organization like the fellowship in terms of its access or clout among the country's leadership, and examples of that abound in Charlotte's book. In a recent year, the Family's Fellowship Foundation budgeted $12 million, a fraction of its finances, for mentoring, counseling, and partnering with friends around the world. Mentors create an atmosphere in which a recruit is psychologically broken. This is not new to this particular organization. A lot of fundamentalist groups use the same thing. Broken in order to form a new relationship with a universal Jesus, supposedly common to all belief systems. And somehow they're managing to convince people in other populations and other cultures and other religions that either they're convincing them that it's true or they're willing to do whatever they have to do to get access to power. So, the family sponsored National Prayer Breakfast and smaller prayer meetings within the U.S. and foreign governments are major means of expanding networks of the powerful religious elite. Prayer is window dressing compared to unadvertised workshops and private meetings that are part of the larger national event. Major outcomes are recruitment, personal covenants, significant man-to-man money and goods exchanges, formation of new prayer cells, and political decisions in a family recruit's favor. And with that, I'll turn it over to Susan.
Okay. In April 2011, I attended the American Humanist Association National Conference in Boston, along with four other Humanist Union members from Madison. Jeff Charlotte was the keynote speaker on Sunday. Charlotte's multi-week stay with young men being trained by the family's spiritual leaders thrust him into intensive research about the family's history, its worldwide networks, and motivation of its members. In addition to recording his personal experiences, Charlotte conducted interviews and delved into 592 boxes of the family's historical documents at the Billy Graham Center for Archives at Wheaton College. There's a Billy Graham Center for Archives at Wheaton College. Since at least three speakers mentioned this place, apparently
in
it's
Illinois.
A very
it's
good
Wheaton College. It's an even
place to get information research.
Yeah, some relatives by marriage, my second marriage, and my father, who were very. He's gone to Wheaton College and lived right next to it. So.
Go ahead.
There's a very impressive museum there, the Billy Graham Museum, that includes a permanent exhibit about the rise of evangelicalism. In America, and the architecture, not from the outside, but the inside, is very impressive.
Okay.
Charlotte's first book, The Family, was published in 2008, but didn't get the notice it deserved. Then on July 24th, 2009, the Secret of Families cover was blown wide open with these words, "As much as I didn't talk about the Appalachian Trail, that wasn't where I ended up." Governor Mark Sanford revealed he had cheated on his wife. In tears, Sanford violated the family's code of invisibility by mentoring his spiritual advisor at the family's C Street apartments. Soon the universe knew that Mark Sanford, Senator John Ensign, and Representative Chip Pickering, all who had had extramarital affairs, were housed or counseled by the family. Suddenly, Jeff Charlotte, the only reporter to have an inside view of the family, was in hot demand. The day following Sanford's confession, Michael Jackson died, preempting Charlotte's appearance on the Rachel Maddow show. Soon after, Charlotte could be heard widely on radio, television, and on public speaking platforms. The first two chapters of his C Street book are devoted to the C Street scandals and his implications. As Charlotte relates, Ensign, Pickering, and Sanford were supported and nurtured by the family because all parties believed these three men were placed in power by God. They are among his new chosen, his tools with which to advance his kingdom. Beside that ambition, all personal failings pale. The story of King David, told enthusiastically to young family recruits, is relevant here. King David's recovery, after seducing Bathsheba and killing her husband, provided a face-saving biblical example for Mark Sanford. According to Sanford, King David fell in very significant ways, then picked up the pieces and built from there. Humility is the key. Sanford apologized to his cabinet, but vowed to complete his term as governor because, as Charlotte writes, like David, Sanford had a calling. He was chosen. God had put him in office, and God would take him out. Such entitlement allows family members to disregard, if not condone, far worse actions by ruthless strongmen. God-given power, a personal relationship with Jesus, and stated good intentions trump compassion. As long as powerful leaders are converted and deals are being made, such as bargaining military installations for weapons, any gruesome fallout is apparently just parts of God's plan. Cries of the oppressed are ignored. The poor are downtrodden because it is God's will. Similar to Governor Sanford, George W. Bush became convinced God wanted him to be president. As Dolita mentions, Bush belonged to a Midland, Texas Bible study group. It was started by the Navigators, which has received report from the family. Some years before, family leader Doug Coe received spiritual guidance by a Navigators member and worked with the Navigators prior to joining Bereed. As president, Bush had a member of the family on his staff. According to Jeff Charlotte, Bush praised family leader Doug Coe at the 1990 National Prayer Breakfast for what Bush described as quiet diplomacy. I wouldn't say secret diplomacy. Unregistered diplomacy is illegal according to the U.S. government's Logan Act, but the act is toothless. There are no recorded convictions for a violation since the act was passed in 1799.
So much for the Logan Act. Maybe we should revive it.
They sound a little bit like the mafia.
I think they have actually termed themselves the Christian mafia. Or they don't use the term Christian, they use another word, but I think they've kind of, yeah. But
is that because the mafia is Christian?
It took three influential contacts to transform a young, nominally Christian U.S. representative into a stealth diplomat serving all of Africa. First, James Inhofe accepted a senior representative's invitation to attend a weekly house prayer meeting, which introduced him to the family. Sometime later, and this may cover a period of years, a Christian embassy missionary challenged Inhofe to become more zealous. And this triggered Imhoff's emotional coming to know Jesus. Finally, after a challenge by Doug Coe, Inhofe, then a senator, agreed to be the family's key man in Africa. As Charlotte relates, Inhofe's first trip was off the books, paid for by a religious organization. His remaining missionary trips were funded by taxpayers. Inhofe's first task was to convert, or as the family says, reconcile Nigeria's corrupt dictator, Sani Abacha, to a relationship with Jesus. Reconciliation, whether it was for real or whether he was feigning it, paid off when the U.S. dropped sanctions against Nigeria. Abacha's friends, Mobil, Chevron, Ashland, and Texaco, were no doubt pleased. Inhofe worked with the family's youth corp to, and this is, again, I think a widespread organization, the family's youth corp, to recruit younger generations of spiritual warriors aiming for worldwide governance by God's law. Process is this. An American representative such as Inhofe develops a relationship with a foreign country's leader, and this could be just through casual introduction, it may be targeted. The two select five key men from that country who, as Charlotte says, act like spiritual double agents, fluent in two faiths. One faith is required by the politics of their country, the other is the family's. The key men are carefully trained to take the family's spirit of Jesus to the poor. Key men in this case meaning the new people. Through these people, the family gets access to prospective converts, and the foreign government gets access to U.S. favors, which may or may not benefit the young or the poor. As of a few years ago, the fellowship had key men operating in 12 African nations. Another example is Lebanon, where key men select talented youth from family-sponsored English language schools, and they're dotted all over the country. These young people are sent to college in the United States and also given spiritual guidance here. The family's aim is to have them return to Lebanon as loyal contacts, and I think that's a pattern being used worldwide. Key men in Uganda's parliament, and now we've skipped from Lebanon to Uganda, initially supported by Inhofe, John Ashcroft, and Pastor Rick Warren. And the word initially is key here, initially supported by them. They're backing off as soon as to some of the things that are going on. These key men in Uganda turned God's law into a deadly tool, and we'll let Susan enlarge on that.
Put yourself in this scenario. You are a gay person living in Uganda. Your picture appears in the newspaper that announces you are gay. A newspaper cover, referring to gay people, screams, "Hang them." Sometimes afterward, your friend, a gay rights activist, is bludgeoned to death. Supposedly, the motivation was robbery. This is not fiction. At the AHA National Convention, Jeff Charlotte recounted shocking events leading to the legal case of Victor Mukasa and Ivan Oyu versus Uganda's Attorney General. Mukasa was a trans man, born female and living male. A Pentecostal pastor determined Mukasa was possessed by a male spirit and asked his flock to heal her. The exorcism, conducted solely by men in front of thousands of Christians, was shocking, brutal, and sick. They slowly removed Mukasa's clothing and unwrapped her bound breasts. As she cried, they called it liberation. Quote, "They slapped her, but it was holy slapping, and when she stood before them completely naked, the man's hands roaming over her body and then inside, they said that was holy too," unquote. Then they locked Mukasa in a room and raped her for a week as a cure. When it was over, the pastor declared Mukasa was free. That grueling torture convinced Mukasa that the demon was not inside him, but the demons were in the church. He became an activist hunted by the police. When they couldn't find him, they took Mukasa's friend, Ivan Oyu, and gave her the same cure. Oyu and Mukasa sued the Uganda Attorney General and won. The lawsuit spurred a Ugandan parliament member, who is also a member of the Ugandan Fellowship, to introduce a bill that penalizes gays with life in prison or with death, if convicted of a homosexual act. Uganda's ethics minister, also a fellowship member, supports the bill, as do a majority of Ugandans. Members of the Washington, D.C. family claim not to support the bill, but acknowledge they are not speaking effectively against it. fellowship or family groups in the governments of Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania, Zambia, and Congo have requested copies of the bill. The Ugandan Parliament adjourned without discussing the bill, which may be taken up in the next session, expected to begin in June this month.
I tried to get an update on that, and I can't find out what's going on in the Parliament. I think as soon as anything happens, it's going to be on the web, because people, particularly gay groups, are really following this pretty closely. Jeff Charlotte was planning to do research on the family's possible role in Suharto's occupation of East Timor when the family restricted its archives. You can't get in them anymore. He was still able to piece together notes of the family's involvement in Indonesia in some ways during the massacres in both Indonesia and East Timor. Suharto wrested the leadership of Indonesia from Sukarno in 1965. In March 1966, the Communist Party was banned. The following month, after the Communist Party was banned, the family-connected Campus Crusade arrived in East Timor. Family founder Abram Varid declared Suharto's coup a spiritual revolution. So these are little hints that maybe aren't so little. Suharto formally became president in 1969. In 1970, he came to the United States and met in an off-the-record prayer group with Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird and Admiral Thomas Moore. Laird had been in a congressional prayer group prayer cell for many years with Gerald Ford. 1971, family leader Doug Coe helped Suharto organize his first Indonesian national prayer breakfast to celebrate the fifth anniversary of his seizing power, which meant probably in Suharto's mind the celebration of a lot of assassinations, a lot of murders. In 1975, with Ford's approval, Suharto, using primarily American weapons, invaded East Timor on the pretext East Timor was communist. Family members, as well as Presidents Johnson and Ford, remained silent when Suharto's army massacred an estimated 600,000 supposed opponents, both in East Timor and in Indonesia. Suharto's contacts in the U.S. Congress kept him in bullets until he was driven out of East Timor in 1998. Charlotte ponders the destructive logic of faith that allows American politicians to contribute to the nightmares of other nations, and the rest of us, at least some of us, not maybe here, to vote for them. His answer is absolute loyalty to power. The power of men who deem themselves chosen by God, the power of men who demand obedience to a Jesus whose dictates reflect their desires, power of men who have convinced themselves they are serving the poor by helping the rich, the power of men who preach love and gentleness but turn a blind eye to poverty and violence, the power of men who engage in or tolerate criminal acts in the name of their Jesus, men who would destroy all power of the working class and other non-elites, the power of men whose destructive mindset has spread like a virus in our country and across the world, allowing the dispossessed to suffer and starve after warfare, earthquakes, floods, and tornadoes, men who are the antithesis of humanists, who welcome transparency, freedom of thought, and the noise of a secular democratic public. Today, religious elitism, whatever its source, seems to be in the very air we breathe. Power-seeking elitist fundamentalists have made their way solidly into the upper echelons of American government. It troubles me that compassionate religious people, people opposed to theocracy but yet religious, still attend recruitment events sponsored by politicians who preach that our freedoms come from God, not from the government. It bothers me when those attendees come to praise God and destructive behavior doesn't seem to matter. The January 3rd, 2011 Wisconsin State Journal began an article with this sentence. Remember that date, January 3rd, 2011. Believers from many faiths filled a 600-seat Monona Terrace ballroom Monday for an inauguration-related prayer breakfast that stressed shared humanity over political difference. As a humanist, I think shared humanity is a great idea. Not shared humanity is a euphemism for Adrian Vereed's common ground, which Jeff Charlotte defines as forced humanity. Not a one-size-fits-all belief that tempts us away from critical thinking, but the sound of many disagreeing voices coming together where, as James Madison puts it, conscience is held as the most sacred of all property. And with that, the floor is yours.
Wow.
So much for trickle down. That's
trickle down.
Yeah.
Trickle down.
How do they seem together fitting Jesus as the leader and sub-leader and his treatment of the poor versus their treatment of the poor?
It's this notion.
Like they're rewriting the Bible. They're
reinterpreting it. And I think they're finding some biblical examples, which I could probably look up you can find examples to support anything, but I think they have found. King David, for example. He was powerful. That was more important than anything else.
I think that it may be that there are two different definitions of Christianity. One is following the teachings of Jesus Christ, and the other is worshiping Jesus Christ. That's enough without following any of the teachings.
I'd like to follow up on that because this is a big point of theirs. Theirs is a very unvarnished Christ. They do not call themselves Christian. They do not, and the reason they don't call themselves Christian is they don't want to be affiliated with Christian churches that grew up after Jesus supposedly lived. They want to go back as far in history as they can to an unvarnished Jesus, but a Jesus that had power, but not the trappings of Christianity. So they disassociate themselves with churches.
That his power was how he spoke.
Pardon?
He didn't wield power, he had power as he spoke.
Well,
what he taught people was powerful.
Yeah.
I think the unvarnished.
Well, they don't seem to make any distinction between what we know about a man, the historical Jesus, mm-hmm. and what Christians call Jesus Christ. And once you start calling him Jesus Christ, you're implying that you're believing in this man who we know now existed, was the real Son of God. And that's, to me, a very great distinction.
Yeah.
Between humanists and other, philosophers, and the fundamentalist Christians.
Well, and they do believe in the return of their Jesus to as king.
Well, they do believe.
They believe in that part of it. Yeah, that they are preparing the world for the kingdom.
Yeah, then they are disregarding the story.
It's picking and choosing.
It's a question of power. They're essentially, what I got was they were in love with power. And nowadays, if you just say among certain crowds that you are a follower of Jesus Christ, it's like you are a follower of this, probably the most powerful name in the world.
It's always the best argument. Look at all the pastors that said racism, when first the talk about racism and the wrong and right of slavery came into being. Those who had the argument that God made them black because they were supposed to be natural slaves. Mm-hmm. And their argument was, well, it's a divine thing. Mm-hmm. You call
When it comes to slavery, there are actual quotes saying that slavery is good in the Old Testament.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
New Testament, too.
All you got to do is read one of Annie Laurie Gaylor's books.
Yeah.
She lays out the quotes detailed.
Yeah, Julie had something over here.
I think the most disturbing part of this whole thing with the family is that it's kind of the secretness of it to get to the point where they have infiltrated so many governments, the military. The military is becoming very disturbing to Christian, to the point that the highest levels, I just was in a conversation on Facebook with a military person that was for a mandatory chaplain's retreat that everybody had to attend. It's not that you have a choice any longer, and he doesn't really want to be too vocal about it because he has to serve with these people. You're between a rock and a hard place here, but there hasn't been any president that has not attended the National Prayer Breakfast. Yeah. We're not talking about the National Day of Prayer.
No, the National Prayer Breakfast.
It's a fundraiser. $600 a plate. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody in Congress attends, and every single president, right down to President Obama, has attended this. It's a private thing made to look very political or made to look...
Look as if Congress is sponsoring it. It's made to look as if Congress is sponsored.
Right, but
it is extremely political.
And they all speak at these events for them, for their fundraising events or whatever. But those are the family.
The family.
Which raises another interesting point.
Okay, we've got somebody back here that's ahead of you. You're next. Yeah. Go ahead.
And when we are all absorbed and when we truly believe, what's the plan? What happens? Uh-huh. What goes on? I mean, what happens then?
The plan is that everybody's living under the dictates of God's law.
And what is God's law according to them?
Well, I don't think it's going to include us. No, that's all I'm seeing.
Does it bring any kind of humanitarian substance, peace on?
No,
that's not in their interest.
The poor are placed as poor, and the poor are supposed to be downtrodden, so anybody who is in a position of power should be perfectly free, based on their system, to take any poor and smash their face in if they want to.
That's pretty much it. The poor and the downtrodden, that's the way God intended. If you're wealthy, if you're powerful, you're that way because God made you that way and you are chosen. And so basically, it's the kingdom of God for God's chosen people, I guess, to put it in a nutshell. And whether there are disadvantaged people around afterwards, that's not their concern. He's next, right here.
Well, I was just going to make a frivolous comment, but you used the commonplace metaphor that their way of thinking has spread like a virus. Mm-hmm. And when you said that, it occurred to me that certainly the effects are similar. But viruses don't have bank accounts. And they don't have advocates on talk radio.
Yeah.
That's how it spreads to a great deal.
Go ahead.
Well, I kept thinking, and you might attack me for that, but I kept thinking all the while, this is not only a Christian thing. This is a fundamental, the goals are the same as a fundamentalist Islamist thing. Sure. And they have the same kind of inroads, underhanded inroads into things.
But you see, they are trying to outdo that. Yeah. They're working throughout the Middle East, and they're trying to outdo them at their own game in terms of the inroads.
Yeah, no, they are doing a hell of a lot better than the Islamic people are.
Yeah. In the ancient Israel, there was the Jubilee, and every 50 years, and it was people were forgiven their debts, you could start all over. I believe slaves were free. I believe there could be hereditary slavery forever. So even that was also, not to be rude, but James Madison was a slaveholder.
Yes, that's true.
About him, and just about Haiti in the beginning, you know, Haiti was the side of Hispaniola that Columbus landed on. They deforested Haiti. You probably know all this, so you know that's why that side has been. And then when there was the slave revolt, the only successful one in the Western Hemisphere that lasted like 9 or 13 years under Toussaint Louverture.
Yes.
They defeated Napoleon. Ever since, the United States and France have treated Haiti horrifically.
That's right.
Jefferson and the French government, both revolutionary governments, refused to recognize Haiti. And we have a very long history. We got rid of Aristide, who just recently returned. There's a wonderful book by Randall Robertson about that. But so, yeah, so we have food sitting with hungry people outside, and we don't give a...
Absolutely.
So we treated them like they didn't deserve to win their revolution.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. And they have
destroyed their
supposedly country. They have pride that other black people have been denied because they know who they are, that they could, you know, triumph and so on. So we're determined to make sure.
Okay.
Is there any good way of now publicizing these writings through mainstream media?
It's happening. Charlotte's been on mainstream media a fair amount. He's been on Rachel Maddow. He's been on a number of shows. But as you well know, mainstream media goes in kind of just blips of things. And so this will go away from mainstream media, I think. He's made videos. He's given talks all over the place. But it's got to be taken, I think, beyond Jeff Charlotte. There are other writers that are into it. But the fact that... Here the guy came out with two books, was giving presentations, was making videos. I first read about him in 2003. I read the article in Harper's Magazine about this, which is when I first started getting into it.
I think I first heard about him on Amy Goodwin.
Yeah.
On Democracy Now!, she was the first person to interview him.
Was Amy Goodman? I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Very recently?
No. This has been around quite a long time.
But it's been pretty much ignored, I think.
Well, it's in the progressive side. We're always fighting this constant battle. It was only I think last year that C Street House lost its tax exemption. It was considered a church.
Oh, they lost it.
They lost it.
I hadn't heard.
They lost that. And then Melanie Sloan from CREW, that's Citizens Responsible for Ethics in Washington, she filed complaints with the Congress, with Ethics, the Ethics Board, because all of the members of Congress that stay at C Street House pay like $600 a month, mm-hmm. which is like way less
nothing.
Than any kind of, amount they should be paying if you're looking at market rate. And for that, they got laundry service, they got food, I mean, everything, And they said, well, we were just renting a room. Well, even a room in Washington is about $1,500 a month.
Yeah.
And so they were looking at their, if they didn't claim that on their taxes as a donation, then they would have to pay that money back.
Wow.
So it has had other ramifications.
Good.
of the people that were living there.
But on the other hand, as you were saying, he initially got to be able to basically walk in with a friend through the front door, but at the end of his talk, he was saying that nowadays they vet anybody who goes in the door. And
well, when he first, the only reason he went there was his daughter, his sister's husband, or that was he's Jewish.
Yeah.
So Charlotte is Jewish,
mm-hmm.
and so they don't discriminate against the fact that you're not Christian when you go there.
He was taken there by a friend.
Yeah, but he went there because his sister's boyfriend or husband was going there, and she was concerned it was a cult. So he said,
"It is a cult.
I'll check it out." And when he got there, he thought, well, how odd is this whole thing,
And he did not intend to write two books
write
or go into the...
He didn't find out about it and start investigating it. He actually... lived there for I think 6 or 8 months or something or whatever. And they were very welcoming and open to him. I mean,
and he initially intended to write on religion. He's just a man who's been curious about various religious communities. He's traveled all over the country living in various religious communities and was planning on writing a book about that. And then after this, he was, as you say, he found it so strange and so probably disturbing. That then he started doing it, and then when he found the treasure trove in the library, then he really got into very serious research.
Dan Brown has to write a whole book on it and make it into a big film.
But here you've got a tax exempt organization that's about as transparent as mud, and how have they been allowed to be that tax exempt for that long without having their records for public view? I mean, why aren't there historical records?
They claim to be a religion.
Pardon?
They claim to be a religion.
Well, they got it's not any different than Family Radio had the one that announced the rapture. As long as you have a 501c3, you're considered a nonprofit. And once you're considered a nonprofit, they don't go back and keep checking. There was a place in Elgin, Illinois, and all they did was store Bibles. It was a big warehouse, and they claimed that as tax exempt. And when they finally looked into it, they go, "Well, you're not. This is not a church. You can't call this building a church." And they took away their tax exemption, and they had to close it down because they couldn't afford it once you had to pay taxes on the property. Yeah.
One of the hardest things both Americans, United Patrician State, and the Freedom From Religion Foundation have found out is that the other nonprofits, these things like, for example, my union, the IRS is willing to check out, but one of the hardest things for the to get the IRS to check out are anything under the religious nonprofit status.
Well, that was one of the things Freedom From Religion Foundation is doing with, there's not that many churches that actually provide parsonages. You know, years ago when ministers were hardly paid any money, they provided housing. But now they give them these more or less mansions. Who's the one? The guy from Saddleback Church.
Is that Rick Warren?
Rick Warren, yeah. He double dips. He takes the deduction for the the housing, but then he gets it, it's given to him free from the church. Mm-hmm. So it's like they want to close that loophole where you can't also take it off your taxes as a, how can you write off something you never paid for in the first place? But it's interesting that Rick Warren gave the invocation or
that caused a lot of flack.
I know. I mean, I feel very, I know it's kind of like if any of you are old enough to remember Rosemary's Baby when she finds out that the doctor next door is actually Satan or whatever. I'm just waiting for that. I'm just waiting for the day when Barack Obama stands up there and the lightning's coming out of his eyes and realize the truth here.
What surprised me, I mean, I've known for a long time that you aren't supposed to clandestinely advocate for foreign officials, foreign countries, that's illegal. And I've heard people kind of get slapped for it, but I was pretty surprised to see that the Logan Law has been sitting there since 1799, and there have been, no indictments, no prosecutions. No.
That amazed me.
Yeah. I have to go back and look and see where I found that information. I think I can find it.
Somebody has to have been prosecuted for being an unregistered agent.
Being unregistered agent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it seems like it's just toothless.
How do you know how this kind of stuff is doing in Europe?
They are not, I don't think they're focusing on Europe as much. Vareed was. Early on they were, and in fact I think there was quite a division in the group when Doug Coe took over, because Doug Coe's the one that just spread it all over and pulled it out of Europe.
Oh, I see.
So as to what's going on there now, I don't know.
Are the Koch brothers involved in this?
I don't know.
It's very hard to find out.
I've been looking up as much as I can. And I can be a fairly decent snoop, but I don't
put any ideas in there.
There's not much advertisement as to what their religious status is, but they are listed under fierce libertarians. So I think they may be more political than religious.
I don't know. I know a lot of very, very fundamentalist Christians that are libertarian.
Mm-hmm.
Homeschoolers.
Mm-hmm. When you figure that the prime, as far as I can tell from my reading, which is not by any means complete, you can look at these books, you'll see red marks in some places and long stretches of absolutely pure, clean paper. But from what I can tell, the primary corporate interests that the family is concerned with is oil and defense. That this is where the wheeling and dealing is going on. And it's connecting people in various countries, and AFRICOM is one of our country's big projects right now. It's one of the family's big projects right now. And the linking of corporate interests and the governments that want and the governments that have. And that's, and in exchange, then the family gets access to converts, prospective recruits, I guess is a better word.
I mean, there may be family ties. I mean, we have Scott Walker, who calls himself a born-again Christian. Rebecca Clefitch, who also calls herself a born-again Christian. And then you got Mike Hoops, who went to one of those ultra-Christian colleges in the South. Do you remember which one that was?
I used to know. I can't remember now.
Yeah. So, I mean, they all have high ties to very rightist Christian behaviors, the three top people in that organization. I don't know about
Scott
the
Walker has, in his, at the prayer, in his speech at the prayer breakfast, and I can't quote him exactly, but basically made this, and I think I referred to it in here, made the statement that freedom comes from God, not from governments.
I was wondering, one of your early statements, you said Varee was anti-union and pro-New Deal.
Anti-New Deal. Anti-New Deal.
Oh,
did I say pro-New Deal? Wash out my mouth.
No. What she did is she said anti-union and New Deal. So the ante went to both of the words. She probably should have said it. That was double.
Glad we cleared that one up.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I noticed that.
Yeah.
Right. Technically speaking, you can't be New Deal and anti-union at the same time.
Yeah, in fact, there was a lot of anti-New Deal. And it's almost being mirrored now. And so one of the points that Charlotte made and is that just because, let's say, if we should happen to have another change in government or another change in our state government where this is reversed, this isn't going to go away. Mm-hmm. It's just not.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that people in the reverse aren't going to also be influenced by these folks.
That's right.
Because it seems like
they have
their tentacles really far.
And what they say, they find it a challenge. Their best challenge is to recruit and reconcile an enemy or someone's. I mean, just my virtue of being here and talking about this, I am now probably as close to Satan as I can get. I may be called a Satan for doing this. And
well, that security has you.
On the other hand, I mean, they're still at the point, and even Charlotte was sort of hinting at it, that if he went in there, mea culpa, et cetera, they'd probably take him in just to try and retrain him again.
They actually came to Charlotte, one of their, quote, spies, came to Charlotte, and they were having I think that was the one where they were having a conversation, and he just thought it was someone interested, and then gradually it began to realize that this was someone representing the family. They invited him to come back. Mm-hmm. And I think they thought this is a really smart guy if we can turn him.
I'm surprised he hasn't had a strange accident. I think they have ways of...
Well, way back here in the back. Go ahead. Hi.
I was just going to say that the recent attempts to undermine education is going to create a whole lot of recurrence that aren't going to know the difference.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at the...
Oh, sorry, behind you.
Yeah, I think Governor Walker is not so much with the AFC, but with Alex, this Association for the Legislative Exchange Council, and also the American Fellowship for Federation for Children, which is about homeschooling.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're much more corporate than religious.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. I mean,
they're the ones that actually have given over the model bills to many of the governors, and including Walker,
yes,
already sort of written out.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And they're just taking those bills and passing them.
Yeah, and so there's similarities. One of the professors at the university, I think one of the ones that's leaving, gave a talk about how he saw that they were so similar from Wisconsin and I guess
Indiana.
That they were from the same source, and it seems to be that Legislative Council.
Right.
I think there have
they
been
have some similar goals. I think that the
why is this not
council
conspiracy?
Is much more religious, and the rest is simply about corporate power.
I think the foundation is about corporate power.
Yeah, they hide behind religion. It's a good cover.
And I agree with you. The Alec, I actually also wanted to know if there was any interchange between Alec and the foundation. I have a dog named Alec. It bothers me. And I think that there are people who may be connected to both, but I don't know if there's a direct connection between Alec and the foundation.
They seem to have similar goals.
Yeah.
It just does seem, I was going to say the same thing, that there's a rise of the corporation, and that their purpose is to keep powerful people in power so the money can be funneled to the right connections. And that just seems to have taken over the world.
Why is it not conspiracy?
Well, it is.
It is.
Why aren't we fighting conspiracy?
We are. That's why we're here, Mike.
There should be a term of conspiracy.
With school vouchers and that whole trying to undermine public schools is money corporate. You know, there was all this government money going to educate children. Well, why can't we have some of that? Mm-hmm.
It's to some degree, but if you also can, I mean, with the school voucher thing, there are other forces at work there, because if you listen to healthy corporations, they want seriously well-educated people. Corporations are like politicians. There's really good ones, and there's tinkers, like the Koch brothers. So, I mean, the really good ones, the healthy ones, they want really good educated workers, and even some of the best ones treat their employees so well. Like one of them, company I know and know out there in Washington, a computer software thing where I'd move if I wasn't paranoid about health insurance, has a doctor on the premises so the employees don't even have to take a whole bunch of sick leave to go off and see the doctor.
Those aren't the corporations that are trying to undermine the school system. Yeah. But there are those that are trying to undermine the school system.
They wanted to raise a tax on the wealthiest people in Washington State, and the money would have gone towards education. Huh? And Microsoft, the people at Microsoft had a huge campaign against it, a lot.
Yeah.
Sam Harris wrote a really good kind of an editorial about that. Is like, who does Microsoft think is going to buy their computers if we have a totally dumbed down economy? Yeah. Yeah. We have kids that are stupid.
That's right.
Who's your future customer?
I'd like to get back to the issue of Scott Walker. I think the one thing that connected me to him was his use, was not that he's governed, you know, not the Koch brothers, not Alec, but the prayer breakfast. And I cannot assume that every prayer breakfast is connected with the family. I mean, I think it's something that may have been picked up and used in other ways, but the pattern of it and the things that were said, that he had, that was an important part of his inauguration, B, that he invited a wide gamut of people who weren't necessarily his followers, but they were all connected by their belief in Jesus, and then the comment that he believes that freedom comes from God, not from government. So those were the three things that kind of caught my eye. And he may not be connected to the family at all. So you may be on very solid ground.
If liberation theology rose up, you wonder how many of these people would be deserting the ship. deserting the Jesus ship.
Yeah.
But as with most politicians, the only way you really find out is they do something like Mark Sanford did, which is stand up in front of cameras and talk about it. Because this organization thrives on secrecy, and, you know, he basically wandered into it almost by accident, Jeff Charlotte did, and they're vetting their people more these days. They restricted the access to the library archives, so they're even trying to do the secrecy stuff. The reason C Street came out is because they started aiming towards more international stuff after his family book came out, sort of things.
And women involved at all?
Yes, but I would say, for example, one of the people who came to kind of spy on Charlotte was a woman. Women are in some, like Hillary Clinton being in a congressional prayer cell. But the people, as far as I can tell, all the people who are out in, whether they're the key men of the organization, where they're in that the outer ring of people who are going out making contacts in foreign countries, and then when most of them are male, and that's by intent.
And the men were allowed to have their affairs at C Street House.
Yeah.
Most of the guys had two women.
Yes, rooms. That was the role of the women. So.
Yes, she brought up a point that the young people, young people stayed in a place called Ivanwall, which is where he stayed when he was there. So he was with younger recruits. The men were at Ivanwall, and the women were in another place. And the women, as she says, you know, they cleaned. And I don't think they were. I don't think they got a whole lot of spiritual counseling. I think they were.
They don't care what they think.
Yeah. And the men, you know, they were not churched. The spiritual counseling was minimal, and they played games a lot and did sports. And
I always thought that all the top deals were brokered in playing a game of golf. I wonder if these guys play golf.
They pray. Spell it whichever way you want to.
Isn't there a bit in one of these books of a politician going out to play tennis or something?
Deleted, can you describe this C Street must have been a big complex of buildings and
they aren't all in the same place. There's C Street, which is it's not like a huge high rise, but it's a multi-story Washington D.C. brick building on C Street. That's where they house the senators or the congressmen.
And it's not just Republicans either; there's Democrats.
Yeah, that's true. Ivanwall, and I'm not sure exactly where that's located. That's where they house the male students. I think the women are someplace else. And then they have a place called the Cedars, which is where they bring in people from other countries.
Are you talking about government itself?
I'm talking only about the family organization, the family group that I've been talking about. They've got various properties.
They're worth millions of states of properties.
What is their legal status? I don't understand. As a corporation or
a church?
They call themselves a church, but as she said, they lost their nonprofit status.
For C Street House, they lost their property tax exemption for that building. They were not paying property taxes on it for years because it was called a church.
The rest of it, they're a nonprofit, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the group itself didn't lose that, but you can't call something a church unless you actually function as a church facility.
They have a separate foundation, which I think is called the Family Foundation Fund or something like that. And that's what funds the people who go out into other countries and recruit, and I don't know what else it funds. So they've got a separate foundation, and they have their fingers in a lot of different pies. But what happens with money is pretty doggone hard to track down, because there's mano a mano hand exchange of money going on who knows where. So there's individual exchanges of money. There's exchanges of maybe on a handshake of weapons for access or whatever. So there's a lot that's going on that is just off the books, that's all.
Well, I think we should thank our speaker for
Hope we haven't ruined your day. Go out and walk in the flowers.